being high on Waisak, so you don't need to get high on ganja, on crystal meth, on what's these other drugs? Ice, weed, ecstasy, this. Oh, alcohol, you can get high on Waisak. And that's actually very true, because I recall, I've still got good memories. My first Waisak when I was 18 years of age. That really inspired me and impressed me, because this is a real holy day. Now, you know, the Buddha, he didn't get reborn in poverty, like leaders of some religions, because the Buddha had much better karma than that. And his enlightenment, he didn't get executed, he actually sat under a tree and actually got wise and very skilled, and he died very peacefully. So actually we're celebrating an incredible being. Now, someone asked me a question at the very beginning, which is an interesting one, because you read the books, some things in the books have been added. Because what happens, there's actually a word in English, and it's called hagiography. What happens if someone becomes a saint, or at least they're a famous teacher, then many, many stories get added onto them. Hopefully you never do that to me, because it may be the teacher in the next temple up the road. And his supporters say, oh, my tulku is much better than Ajahn Brahm. Say, no, Ajahn Brahm is much better than your tulku. And you get like competition, and in order to do that, you actually add things on, and you add and add and add and add. Ajahn Brahm could read minds. He could fly in the air. He could do magic tricks. You just do that because, you know, you're proud of the people, you know, who you support. And that's called hagiography. So in many, many religions, we know that actually we add on things over the years. Now, that actually happened to Ajahn Chah, because this is, no, he, in his lifetime, I was one of his disciples. It happened one day when he was still, you know, sort of reasonably young, but starting off as abbot of his monastery. And one day someone came to that monastery to listen to the talk, and it was pouring down with rain, and the roads hadn't been sealed yet. So this man got stuck in the mud in his car. And he just couldn't get out. It was pouring down with rain. He didn't want to get out of the car. And then he was so impressed. Through the car windows, he saw this monk come out of the forest. And this monk was just so compassionate, even though his robes were sort of getting soaked and getting splattered with the mud, he pushed this man's car out of the mud so he could go to the hall to listen to the talk. And the man saw that monk, Ajahn Chah. The great monk was humble enough and kind enough to be able to get out and push the man's car out from the mud so he can go to the talk. So he got to the hall, and there he saw in the hall, very well lit, Ajahn Chah sitting there with dry robes, with no mud. Oh my goodness, this is psychic power. This is supernatural. He saw it with his own eyes. A minute or two ago, Ajahn Chah's robe was wet, smothered in mud. He was helping push him out of the mud, and now he's sitting in the hall giving a talk. How compassionate and kind, and how supernatural can that be? And so he went around telling everybody the great psychic magical power of Ajahn Chah. The true story is that it was Ajahn Chah's cousin, who was a novice at the time, who looked like him. Now remember, it was raining, it was dark. You know, in the rain, in the dark, you can't see people clearly. And because he was a novice, he wasn't actually in the meeting. And even after, he said, no, it wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was me, I did it, I was pushing it through. But no, people wanted to hear the magic power so much. They said, no, he's just covering up for Ajahn Chah, because Ajahn Chah is so humble. Because when people want to believe, you can't convince them otherwise. I'm sure even now there's many, many psychic powers of Ajahn Brahm going around. I deny them. I didn't do it. It was somebody else. But, according to the story, the legend of Waisak, when the Buddha came out of the womb, he walked 7 steps. And he put his finger up, and he spoke. This is my last. Now, I am the chief. This is my last life. Or something like that, anyway. But when I first heard that, I too thought, oh, that's just hagiography. They make up those stories. How can a baby walk? How can a baby talk? But they can. It's weird, but I've collected stories from people I trust. And there's three stories of people who could talk, which I've collected. That's apart from the Buddha. And the first story, it's weird, but I'm telling it now because it was a question asked. This Australian couple, Caucasian, they came to see us one night. They weren't Buddhist, but they had an experience which had just really just shocked and confused them. They had two children, two boys. I think it was Peter and Paul. And Peter was about 3 years of age, and Paul had just been born. Was still sort of a baby, maybe just, you know, a couple of weeks out of hospital. And one evening, the parents told their elder son, it's time to go to bed. Peter, go to bed and go and say goodnight to your baby brother, Paul. So a little three-year-old led over the, what do they call it in Singapore, the pram? Crib, oh, the crib, leant over the crib and said to his baby brother, good night, Paul. And the baby brother, only 2 or 3 weeks old, said, good night, Peter. Now, the parents just couldn't believe what they'd heard. And of course, first of all, you think, I've imagined this, but both heard it. So stunned, they both stared at their two children. And without any prompting, their elder son, Peter, said again, the second time, good night, Paul. And this time they were paying full attention, and they heard their 2 or 3 week old son say once again, good night, Peter. And they were so shocked, they came to see the monks and asked, what the hell's going on? Because this is not what's supposed to happen. But they heard it very clearly. Interestingly, what they heard was in a language or in a tone of voice which wasn't baby speak, was adult speak. You know how a baby talks. If they say, good night, they say it in a certain way. An adult would say it in another way. It was like an adult speaking. And obviously, it was the case that, yes, that can happen. And because I've mentioned that story in public, other people have come up and they've told me, yes, that happened to them. That little baby talked. But they were so concerned that people would think they were mad and send them to psychiatrists. They would never tell anybody. So once I heard that story, maybe the Buddha did speak. But usually what happens, that's just one off, and then they sort of just go back into babyhood. And the next thing they say is goo goo gaga, the real baby speak. It's just like a window opening to the past. A little bit of mindfulness coming from their previous life. Being able to say such things. I've never heard of a baby actually walking, but I have heard one mother in Perth tell me something again which shocked her. She was a Buddhist. She said she was in hospital, and the baby had only been born a few days, had just finished breastfeeding, so she was laying in her bed, leaning up. The baby just finished breastfeeding, and the baby just crawled on the mother's tummy. She was just watching it, sort of sat up, crossed its legs in a full lotus, put one hand over the other, and assumed a meditation posture, closed its eyes. And the mother again was so shocked she came and told me, what the heck's going on? It's about three or four days old, and it was actually meditating. Now, in perfect posture. Because I've seen such things myself, and know such things, sometimes I think, my goodness, maybe that could have happened. At least some of that could have happened. Incredibly powerful being with a lot of memory from a previous life being able to speak. But I must admit, the most famous story, which I didn't know these people personally, but it was reported back to me in an article in a newspaper, in a news magazine. In a magazine. It's the one I like the most because it was actually in a maternity ward in the United States. And when the baby came out of the womb, and straight out of the womb, in front of the midwives and nurses or gynecologists, whoever was there in the room, they all heard this. the baby looked around and said these unforgettable words. As the baby looked around, "Oh no, not again." Imagine, the baby knew it'd have to go to school again. Wear nappies. Every time I wanted to say something, the mother would put this dummy in the mouth. It couldn't say anything. Oh no. Would you like to go back to primary school again? Would you like to wear nappies again? So anyway, that's why it said, "Oh no, not again." So maybe, there may be some truth there. I've got an open mind now. I had a closed mind when when I first heard that story. I thought, that's just rubbish. That's not important. But there are some amazing things which happen in the world, and I've seen quite a few of them. So my credibility is increased now. Maybe those things did happen. But in particular, when he put his hand up and said, "This is my last life." Now, again, as a Buddhist, we think for ourselves, we challenge. And sometimes I know, how could he have known that was his last life? For those of you who know a bit about Buddhism, you know the four stages of enlightenment, which are the stream winner, means you've got the most seven lives left in samsara. You've got the once return, has only got one life left. The non-return, and no more lives left. This is one life in the Suttawasana, and that's so you never come back again. And the arahat, this is your last life. And I was taught that before the Buddha became a Buddha, he practiced for so many years to perfect his wisdom. But then when I started reading the ancient Buddhist teachings, this one monk, he pointed out to me a very interesting sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is core Buddhist teachings, which everybody accepts as original, as early. It's called the Gatikara Sutra. The Buddha taught this. He said, a long time ago, in the time of Kassapa the Buddha, because our Buddha, Gautama the Buddha, is only the most recent. There was one, there'll be other ones in the future, there were other Buddhas in the past. So in that sense, sometimes we do claim Buddhism is the oldest religion. It's been going, not for centuries, but for eons. Even the previous eons, it was Buddhism. I don't know, but anyway. He was saying, in the time of the previous Buddha, there was a potter called Gatikara, who was a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, a chief disciple. He was very poor. He would have become a monk, but his two parents were blind. He was the only son, the only child, so he had to look after his mum and dad. And his profession was making clay pots. But because he was such a devout follower of the Buddha Kassapa, he would not even dig the earth in case he killed a worm or a beetle. So the only way he could get his clay was when a mouse or a rat dug a hole, or when people were building the dikes in their paddy fields. He would take some of the excess soil as his clay, and he would use that to make pots. That's how much he kept that first precept of not destroying even animals. Even if it was unintentional, by accident, he was so careful. And number two, he would never sell his pots. Now that's how pure he was. He was not interested in money or making money. What he would do, he'd make the pots, bake them, fire them. He'd put them on a bench outside his dwelling with a sign, "If anyone wanted a pot, please take them for free. If you want to leave some rice or beans, for me and my family, please leave them." It was this beautiful barter, but not saying, one pot for one bag of rice. It was just totally on the trust and love system. And that's something which, as Buddhist communities, we try and emulate. For example, at Jhana Grove, our monastery, our retreat center, there's no fees for staying over there. You can enjoy the place as much as you like. If you want to leave a donation, fine. Similar to Gatikara the Potter. And that's really inspiring to me. When we don't charge for anything, just like Gatikara would not charge for his pots, would trust people. If they take a pot, he's a nice guy, got blind parents, I will leave some rice and lentils in return. That trust is what we call Buddhist business, where we look after each other and care for each other, rather than thinking, this pot is worth so much, how can I get it cheaper? So, and this Gatikara, he had a friend called Jyotipala. And Jyotipala was one of these free thinkers, one of these people who would like to listen to other people, but he said, look, these monks, they don't do any work. They just get looked after by other people. What do they know about real life? And he was actually so critical of the Buddha Kassapa that no way did he ever want to go and see Kassapa. He even called him a shaven-headed fool. But one day, this Gatikara just wanted to try and get his best friend Jyotipala to see the Buddha. So he actually pulled him by the hair. And Jyotipala was shocked. He said, you go that far? You're hurting me to try and get me to see your teacher, this Buddha Kassapa? He must be something. So for the first time, Jyotipala went to see the Buddha Kassapa. I was so impressed and inspired that he soon became a monk. And the story continues, but the end of the story. So the person relating the story, our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, he said, that was me in a previous life. I was Jyotipala. Now that really tells you where the Buddha came from. And that's not that long ago in the whole system of rebirths. I would actually say it's more than likely the Buddha's previous rebirth, birth in this human realm. He was a monk with another Buddha. And before he became a monk, he was even critical of a Buddha, calling him a shaven-headed fool. So that actually shows where our Buddha came from. Not years and years or lifetimes and lifetimes of development, but seeing a Buddha, getting inspired. And I often thought, if you were a monk studying under a Buddha, I mean, surely you'd get something. Surely be a streamer or a once returner. So I reckon it's only circumstantial evidence, but it's convincing that Gatikara, or rather his friend Jyotipala, studied under Kassapa, became a once returner. So when he was born this last life, he knew, this is my last life. So what he was actually saying was something you already knew. And he had enough power of meditation by being a monk under a Buddha, the previous Buddha. Quite likely he would have that power of mind to recall in the first days of his life where he came from before he lost all of that and became a baby again. That may be true, and I think it probably was true. If anyone wants to check that out, look in the books. And you may also know in the Devaputta Sangyuta, there again is some stories. So just after our Buddha's enlightenment, one of the first people who came to congratulate him was Gatikara. Even though this was from the time of the previous Buddha, if you become a non-returner, you go and stay in this Sudhavasa, the pure abodes, for long periods of time. So Gatikara reportedly, this is one of the teachings in the Sutta Pitaka, came down to congratulate his old friend Jyotipala. Said, in our previous life we were students of the Buddha. You had the good karma to become a monk. I was still a layperson. I became sort of a non-returner. And now you become a Buddha. He said, we used to live in the same village, the best friends. Congratulations on becoming a Buddha. That's what it says. So maybe that actually story has got some validity to it. But the most important part is not so much the birth. The next most important part is actually, obviously, the enlightenment under a Bodhi tree. And when I first heard that, as an 18-year-old, I was really inspired. Because this was something really pure. As an idealistic young man, I wanted the very best. I didn't want sort of second best. I wanted to really do something in this world. And amazing that someone could actually be pure. You know, beautiful virtue. Not harming anybody. You read those stories of people trying to kill him. And what did he do? No, he didn't just forgive these people who tried to assassinate him. He taught them loving kindness of Buddhism, and they became stream winners. It's amazing just the power of this person didn't harm any living being at all. I must admit, in my life I've harmed beings. I remember the time when I was My father had just died, so my mother was in the flat just with myself, and a mouse was running around the house. My mother was terrified of mice. So I thought I should be the man of the house. So even though I was inclining towards Buddhism at the time, I bought a mouse trap. And the worst thing was when I caught that mouse. I will never forget that. In the mouse trap, the ones with a little bar which slams and breaks the mouse's neck. I caught that mouse and I saw this dead mouse. As I was taking it to the trash cans, I was stroking it. It was such a beautiful animal. It was so soft. It was just like a cat. You know, you stroke a cat, it's just beautiful fur and nice and soft. And when I sort of realized I'd killed that mouse, I felt terrible. I really remember that. It was one of the most important experiences of my life. I realized I should never do such things. So, you know, I realized from experience what happens when you kill something. Even as only a mouse, and it was for the right reason. You know, I had a reason for it, because I thought I was protecting my mother. But still, it was a terrible thing to do. So you see, a Buddha was so compassionate and so kind. And I wanted to have something like that to live up to. I must admit, the other sort of religious leaders, they didn't match up to a Buddha. They were either going to war, converting people. They were sending goats off cliffs. You know, they were telling people just to abandon your father and mother and follow me instead. There was never that sort of softness and that kindness and compassion which I saw in the Buddha. Remember, I was exposed to the other religions, especially the Christianity and Judaism in my upbringing. You know, I'd never actually seen, and just being honest, compared just the kindness and compassion of a Buddha, would just love everybody and every being, even though they're going to go and kill them. I often remember the story of the mad elephant, Nalagiri, charging towards the Buddha, trying to kill him. Because there was, no matter who you are, there's always some people will actually criticize you. There's no person in this world, not even a Buddha, who won't have his enemies. I've got my enemies, you've got your enemies. But the Buddha's enemies tried to assassinate him. And one of the tricks they used was actually to intoxicate this elephant, Nalagiri. They give him sort of alcohol, this huge animal, and set him free in the early morning. Now, I don't know if you've been, well, you may not have been to India, but have you ever been to London? And how narrow the streets are there. It's amazing you get two cars passing in some of those streets. And these were lanes, you know, in India. And this elephant was running down. There was no way to get out of its way. So people were running for their lives as this elephant was charging down the street. As they were running for their lives, they saw the Buddha and his monks coming in the opposite direction. This was what was supposed to happen. The elephant was supposed to charge down the narrow lanes, knowing the Buddha was coming on arms round, to kill the Buddha. Or at least to really seriously injure him. So people were running in opposite directions, and they shouted out to the monks, "Escape quick, get out of the way. There's a wild elephant coming in this direction." Now these were holy monks, remember? So most of them climbed up the trees, jumped over the walls. All except two. It was the Buddha and his faithful attendant, Ananda. Now, if you know the story of the Buddha, Ananda would actually love the Buddha. It's like, you know, he's like his father, a spiritual leader. And so Ananda could not sort of abandon his teacher. So what Ananda did, he wouldn't run away. He went and stood in front of the Buddha. "Let the elephant kill me. I'll sacrifice myself for my beloved teacher." Now that was an act of sort of courage, sacrifice for someone else. Wasn't that beautiful? And I often ask people, because many of you have been listening to my talks and following me for a long time, if that was me, would you run up a tree or would you stand in front? "Let the elephant kill me rather than Ajahn Brahm." I think most of you would be up the tree. But with the Buddha, he didn't need that sacrifice. So he gently pushed Ananda out of the way. "It's very sweet, Ananda, but look, I can look after myself." And so I often thought of that meeting, because it was symbolic. drunken rage meeting wise compassion? Which one would win? Because much of our world is like that. Drunken, violent rage seeking for justice, or peaceful compassion. Which is the most powerful? In that particular case, and it's symbolic, wise, peaceful compassion won. Because I could imagine the story. As Nalagiri came up to the Buddha. Now the Buddha did have psychic powers. That was not just added on afterwards. If the Buddha had wanted to, as I've often explained, he could have quickly, just like one of these martial artists in the movies, grabbed the elephant's trunk, swung him 3 times around his head, and thrown him 200 miles over the Ganges River. Look, he was superhero. But that's not the way of Buddhism. Not violence. Instead, what the Buddha would have done, this wonderful compassion, these are the words I explain it as. The Buddha would have said, Nalagiri, the door of my heart is fully open to you, no matter what you ever do to me. You can squash me under your powerful feet, and I forgive you. You can pick me up with your trunk and smash me against the walls of the house, break all my bones, I forgive you. Because Nalagiri, no matter what you ever do to me, I will always love you. I care for you. Unconditionally. Just as I'm saying that, can you feel its power of real, sincere, unconditional love? That is so powerful. And it just comes from me. Imagine that coming from a Buddha. That just makes you cry. That just makes you just, I can't harm this person. I can't. And even though you're a drunken elephant, you just can't harm a person who's got really 100% sincere, full, unconditional love for you. I don't know if you've ever received such love. I mean really 100%, whoever you are, wherever you go, truly I will always care and love you. I mean that. If you do receive that, you're just one lucky person. I received that from my father. I never forgot it. And I try and give that to each one of you. No matter who you are, no matter what you say, no matter what you do to me, I would always care for you. That elephant just broke down. His anger, his drunkenness just vanished. He was just bowing to the Buddha, and the Buddha stroking his trunk. That's the power of incredible, unconditional, selfless, no strings attached, loving kindness. When I heard stories like that, I got high. I mean really high. This was inspiring me. Because I really wanted something I could believe in. Something which would uplift me. Something which, maybe I would never reach those heights, but I wanted to know those heights existed and give me hope and meaning for life. That's what I'm going to try and do. May not get there, but just by having that as my goal, I might get halfway, and that's really worthwhile. So when I heard about such stories, about what actually a Buddha is, not a statue, not something you worship, but what's in the mind, what's in the heart of a Buddha? What makes a Buddha tick? When I saw that compassion there, gee, that's what I could worship. So I often say, how can I get that compassion? Or at least get close. Then you heard about what happened on that first Vaisak night. The Buddha was not harming himself. Was not being crucified, was not sort of fighting a war, was doing something just so harmless and simple, and just making peace with himself, and find this incredible peace of meditation. Maybe you may not understand really what meditation is all about, maybe you may have tried it and not really got it yet, but meditation is about being still, just so peaceful. Often I ask people when they start meditating, can you remember the most peaceful experience of your life so far? The time you've been so still and peaceful and content, the time when you may be sitting in your room or sitting by a beach or on a mountain somewhere, and just thinking there's nowhere else in the world I'd rather be than just right here. I don't need anything, I'm just totally at peace in this moment, just being here. Those moments give you a taste of what meditation is all about. Total contentment. Just not wanting to be anywhere else, but right here with you in this hall on Sunday, whatever it is. Isn't that telling you what meditation is all about? Peace, stillness, contentment. You can actually feel it. Now take that deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And you get an idea what the Buddha felt under the Bodhi tree. Incredible, still, peaceful contentment. He didn't need anything. He didn't need a big house. He didn't need a big bank account and a big car. Just an old pair of robes under a tree. Can you open the door of your heart? Oh, it's coming through. Good. Just so peaceful, so still. And so when I was hearing the story of how the Buddha became enlightened, that too was inspirational. It wasn't by like reading a book or doing something hard. Because I don't know about you that, you know, I'm lazy, that, yeah, you know, I like to put effort in, but struggle is so painful. I don't know if you ever trained, you know, in a gym for some sporting event, but oh, you really have to sweat. And it's really tough. Or, you know, studying for an exam, that's really hard work. And does enlightenment have to be that hard? If it is, you know, maybe I'm not cut out for it. But it was going in a totally different direction. Just sitting down, being still, being peaceful. And that was, somehow or other, I thought, now that probably is the way to enlightenment, to actually to feel the peace, deep stillness. So when I heard that story, it wasn't just inspiring me about where this is leading. It really told me what the path was. And it was not about struggle. The first teaching which the Buddha gave after his enlightenment, the middle way, to me is the most powerful. The very first teaching is obviously the one which has the most meaning. And what is that middle way? Just so many people keep missing it. It's not harming your body or your mind. It's the first extreme, Atta-Ginamatanu Yoga. Not doing practices which literally tire your body and mind, which wear it out. You know, we just wear out our body and mind so much. We're so tired. Why is that? Because, you know, we don't rest enough. We don't care. We're just so angry at ourselves sometimes, angry at life. Always just being hard on ourselves and hard on others. Instead of having this beautiful sense of peace. You know, one of the greatest insights in the path towards enlightenment is you're sitting down there one day meditating or just by yourself and getting the great insight, I'm all right. I'm okay. I am good enough. You mean I don't have to be a super duper monk? I don't have to be the most beautiful girl in the whole of Singapore? I don't have to be the strongest, cleverest guy? No, you don't. But I am okay. I don't know about you, I remember most of my life early on, I was working so hard to live up to ideals, trying to meet expectations, whether it was the expectations of society, what people expect you to be, and they demand you to be, what my parents wanted to me to be, what I thought I should do. And that tired me, that wore me out, when I realized I'm okay as I am. Ah, that was just such a relief. All that criticism which you get in life, all those put-downs, all the times you're called stupid, not good enough, and too often you believe that, and to understand and hear from a Buddha, you are good enough as you are. I will love you as you are. You don't have to change a bit, not one of you. You don't have to do anything more. You're lovable as you are, totally. You mean I don't have to try anymore to be better? You're already at the peak of being better. Well done, everybody. You've all graduated. With honors, come Lorde. Isn't that wonderful? Can't you celebrate? I've graduated. Whee! That was what I understood as a middle path, of being at peace with yourself, not struggling and striving. Peace at last. Rest from the struggle and striving to be better, to try and be something else. The end of craving. Freedom at last. When I got that message, number one, I could do that. You could do that. You don't have to be a super girl, a superman. Just accept yourself as you are. So, each one of you is totally open to enlightenment. Now that really made me high. Goodness, you mean even little old me? You may not even be a Buddhist. You may be a Christian, a Muslim, a free thinker, whatever you think you are. You too. Off you go. Be enlightened. Be at peace. Be free. Be absolutely, highly, totally compassionate. Woohoo! So when you understood what was going on there under that Bodhi tree, that was actually, that was impressive. That event, you understand, just according to the teachings afterwards, those suttas, they say after the enlightenment, the Buddha just was sitting there, blissed out for 7 days. If you've got any deep meditation, you understand, and that probably was absolutely true. Blissed out of his head. Total joy, happiness. Because all that struggle now finished. If you think when you graduated from university or when you finished national service, did you feel good? Hey, free at last! Woohoo! Now imagine multiplying that by 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. I mean, really free. That will really sort of inspire you. It showed it was possible. You don't have to be sort of rich or clever. Anyone can do that. That was inspiring. It's simple. Just sitting down, doing nothing. You don't have to be an intellectual. Just need to be you. And in those stories, the other thing which I really liked, you know, in those ways that day, is they told that other people were getting enlightened. Not just men, many women. They got whole books of explaining women becoming enlightened in the time of the Buddha. There, it was equity there. It wasn't only the men could become enlightened. Sorry, girls, maybe in your next lifetime, if you look after the men and serve them and cook for them and wash their clothes and everything else, if you make enough good karma, then maybe in your next life you become a man and become enlightened. That's absolutely rubbish. That's un-Buddhist, and that is just so misogynist that you shouldn't even be in this room. So, it means that we all can. We have that equality. They don't even need to be a monk or a nun. That you too. You don't need to be intelligent. There was these dummies, people who never finished university, never finished school, never even went to school, became enlightened. There was these hunchbacks becoming, these little novices become enlightened. So the whole thing was totally open to anybody. Now, outcasts, the lowest of the low, prostitutes becoming enlightened. That was really radical. Because in our world, we always like to be elitist. You know, only sort of rich people can go into the club. So that anybody could. And that was total radical. When I saw just how anybody, gays, lesbians, transsexuals, you name it, anyone can become enlightened. Criminals. Hoo-hoo. The doors of the deathless are open, said the Buddha. That was really inspiring. Because a lot of times, have you ever felt in life, I can't do this. Maybe other people can, but it's not open for me. Things I would really love to do in life, but somehow or other, all the doors are barred for me. That just really sucks. That's really awful when that happens. Why can't I do that? Why can't I, if I want to stand for election, why can't I do that? You know, I'm a Singaporean, why can't I? Just because I'm not rich or doesn't come from the right family, what's that got to do with it? Just because I'm gay or lesbian or girl or prostitute, why can't I? It's unfair, and it is unfair. So that total equity and fairness there for enlightenment, that was very, actually that's just way ahead of his time. So that inspired me and made me high. That at least in one religion, there was total freedom and equity from the very beginning. We've lost that in many areas of Buddhism because of the cultural overlays, but we're really trying hard to restore that. I'm doing my bit anyway. And isn't that very beautiful to know, as Obama said, yes, we can. That's hope. And without hope, there's no inspiration. You can't get high without hope. So now that's open. The Buddha became enlightened. Blissed out. And what did it actually mean to be enlightened? It wasn't mean he was going to go around converting everybody just, you know, by coercion, by trying to say to them, yeah, if you become a Buddhist, then you can come and join our university, but if you're not, you can't. Not just saying, if you become a Buddhist, oh, then you're going to go to heaven. There wasn't anything to do with that. It wasn't a deal. It wasn't like a business deal. It was a saying that, you know, this is the Dharma, this is the truth. You don't have to call yourself a Buddhist. Because sometimes that people actually, I think it was actually in our newsletter, was it? Say that what we believe in, what's our credo? That we believe in compassion, peace, freedom. So that's what we believe in. Free inquiry, being able to question, finding out for yourself. Just like in modern education, which is now in Singapore, and wouldn't be in your parents' generation. Your parents' generation were told what to believe. They were given facts, and you had to remember them, repeat them in examinations, and then you get your degrees. Now modern education doesn't teach you what to know. It teaches you how to know, how to learn, how to find out. And that's exactly what I always understood as Buddhism. Wasn't teaching you what enlightenment was, even what goodness was. Not telling you what to do, but how to find out what you should do. How to find out, how to learn. With mindfulness, investigation, questioning, not taking anything on face value just because it comes from an Angmo monk sitting up here, but questioning, learning for oneself. And that was very, very inspiring for me. So this is what I learned from that teaching of the Buddha. But of course, like many people, I was really stupid. That first Waisak I went to, this is how high I became. I was high, but I was incredibly stupid. Because one of the things which I remembered when this monk read out the story of the Buddha, in that story it said, before the Buddha sat under that Bodhi tree, he made this resolution. Even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move from this seat until I get full enlightenment. Wow. I thought, that is tough guy. That was like Bruce Willis. Not Die Hard, but Nibbana Hard. People get inspired like that, especially when you're young at 18, macho, tough. So you know what I did? This is a true story. After that service, I went back to my room in college. I was in Cambridge. And I sat down on my meditation seat. I actually did this. And I said, if the Buddha could do it, so can I. So it's so dumb, but I was actually serious at the time. I made a resolution to myself, seriously. My name was Peter at that time. Peter, I'm not going to move from my seat until I get fully enlightened. You know, I had many other things to do that week. And I said that, even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I'm not going to move until I get enlightened. I'm going to stay here, stay put. And I was serious. At that time, I was meditating. I could do 30 minutes, just. 40 minutes had gone past. My God, I was in agony. Everything was burning with pain. And just after 45 minutes, I literally could not stand it any longer. I opened my eyes. I was not enlightened, and even worse, my bones were still there, my blood had turned to dust. I was just so stupid. Because I thought you could get enlightened through willpower. And I thought, well, why not? I had willpower. I'm going to do it. Willpower. No, Bruce Willis, the power. That's not how to get enlightened. That's, and I learned later on, it's like Nala Giri, that's how you get enlightened. I'm not going to use force, I'm not going to use willpower, I'm not going to use aggression. Peace, kindness, gentleness. That's the way. And that, eventually, after many years of being a Buddhist, that really understood what you need to do to become enlightened. It's not an aggressive path. It's not you have to work hard path. You have to be wise path. It's a wisdom skill, not a willpower skill. If it's a willpower skill, there's no way you can do it because you haven't got enough willpower. But you can get enough wisdom power. You don't need to be young. Young people have strength and willpower. Old people, they've lost their strength. Not a lot of their willpower, but they've got wisdom power. So you can still do it. You don't need to be intelligent. Wisdom power and intelligence. Intelligence is what you've learned. Wisdom power is how you see things. And a lot of times you know that it's the universities that stop you being wise. That's why one of my sayings is never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Do you understand that word? Never allow your knowledge to stand in the way of truth. Sometimes we know. That's why we don't see. In other words, we think we know. And we can't actually see what's really there. So, wisdom power, that's the way the Buddha became enlightened. And you read that, and that was told to you, and eventually you got it. And the end of the life, because the last thing we'd get high on in Waisak Day. And to me, now, that last event was the most important. The Parinibbana at Kusinara. If you really understand what this Buddhism is all about, the birth, yeah, it was interesting. Under the Bodhi tree, that was immense. But nothing was as powerful as the last moment of Buddha Gautama's life at Kusinara. Peaceful, no pain, perfectly aware, going into the deep meditations. And totally vanishing, with nothing left at all. A great being escaped from samsara, with nothing left. Now I understand what the Dhamma is. That was immense. The great monks, the nuns, those who became enlightened, when they became enlightened themselves, they became arahats. They used to describe that as a workman or workwoman who's finished their work but hasn't been paid yet. The work has been done, they're enlightened, but the reward hasn't come. The reward comes at the last moments of their life. Free at last, disappeared, gone. Most of you won't understand that. If you understand that, you truly get high on Waisak. This is a person exiting samsara, gone, disappeared, vanished. No other religion even contemplated that. No other sort of teaching could see the beauty in that. That was truly immense, mystical, profound, at the heart of the Buddha's teachings. You may have all heard about teachings of anatta and emptiness. But have you understood what emptiness really means? And its great beauty? That was where the final consummation of a Buddha's career came about at Kusinara. That was why there were some beings, some monks who didn't understand who cried. Other monks who understood and smiled. That was an immense occasion. And again, not a crucifixion, not a sort of a death in agony, not a sort of a death which you see in many hospitals where people are under medication or struggling for the last breath. Absolutely peaceful. Totally still, so peaceful, so still, that when the last moment of peace finished, no more moments arose. Truly. true peace at last. Absolute, perfect, continuing stillness. The Buddha had finished his journey. The end of the road. Home at last. Oh, what bliss. That was the end of the Buddha's career. The final graduation. The great paycheck. The end of samsara. And that truly is unique. Other religions, yeah, they think of heaven. And we always, they argue about which is the best heaven. And who goes to hell, who goes to heaven. Buddhists, we don't go to any of those places. Way beyond heavens and hells. If you understand that, even if you don't understand it, I think there's something inside you resonates. It's that resonation. That's what actually I remember the first Waisak. I didn't understand it. It was beyond my comprehension. But there was something there. There was something incredibly beautiful and profound which somehow I recognized. I couldn't put it into words. I couldn't understand it. But I knew there was something incredibly beautiful there. It's a feeling that the most valuable jewel, the most wonderful thing in the whole your whole series of lives is there for the taking. Other people took that. Many people took that. One day you will take that. I mention this because I told many people in retreats, once you hear teachings like this, I'm sorry, but it's too late. You're going to get there yourselves. If you didn't want to become enlightened, you shouldn't have come into this room. Now the seed's been planted. Bye-bye, samsara. We too will one day leave. Now that really inspires me. It's something which is beyond the world. Beyond anything which I could imagine for the world. Never underestimate this path. This is huge. Mega huge. And in my life as a monk, sometimes I think I can't take any more profundity. This is just so deep and so powerful and so blissful. And it just gets more and more. Incredible, the power of freedom. The power of unconditional love. The power of emptiness. The power of stillness when nothing moves. Wow. That rates me high. And you can see just by the way I gave this talk, I am now incredibly high. I've not only been talking to you, I've been talking to myself. I get inspired too. So thank you for giving me this opportunity. Okay, now questions. Yes. What is the difference between no self and emptiness? I got that question very easily. And it's no difference at all. It's two ways of looking at the same thing. The no self is that's a certain part of what is it which asks the question, who's in here? What about even this nature of this universe? An empty of an essence. Just like the Buddha said, like a bubble. He gave these beautiful similes. Your body is like bubbles on the river. On the outside you can see something, but you poke it and it bursts. There's nothing inside. You think your body is solid. But one day it will just go to the crematorium. If it doesn't go to the crematorium, it will go into the grave where it will get eaten by worms. You know what I recommend when you die? Forget about the cremation. Forget about the burial. Go for recycling. Do you have a recycling service where you can put them in the bins and the local government takes it away to be recycled? Do you have that? In Singapore? Recycling bins for plastic and for other things. So put the bodies in there, get it recycled. Much cheaper than going to do a funeral. So you get the body was just like foam on the Ganges. Pleasure and pain. All the joy and happiness which you feel. He said it was just like a raindrop, plop, on a puddle. There was a Scottish poet called Robbie Burns, one of his poems said, "Pleasures are like poppies spread. You pluck the flower, the bloom is shed." Because this particular flower called a poppy, if you pick it out, all the petals fall off immediately. Or like the snowfall in the river. If you've ever been to the cold northern climates, when snow falls in the river, white for a moment and then gone forever. Just showing just the incredibly fast, impermanent nature of pleasures. And he said, just like a plop of a raindrop falling in a puddle, just for a moment and then gone forever. Your perceptions, the way you look at things, he called like a mirage. A mirage on a hot day, you look at the road and you think there's a puddle of water there. You're not deceiving yourself. It's a real perception. But we give it a meaning it doesn't deserve. And that's where we get all our arguments from. Different ways of looking at the same thing. They are all real, but they're not true. Just like a mirage is real, but it's not true. That's our perceptions. And then we got our will. We call it, this is the khandhas. Of the, called it mental formations, but the most important one of those, according to the Buddha, is one's will. And he said it was like an onion. You peel the onion, and there's nothing solid inside. He actually said it was like a banana tree. There's no pith inside, just leaves around each other. So you peel this thing you call will, and there's nothing inside, nothing solid. It's empty inside. And last of all, your consciousness, that which knows, the Buddha said, that is like a magician's trick. It looks as if there's something there. Have you ever seen magicians? One of our monks could do magical tricks. And he would do little things. He'd get some tissue paper and he'd show you how to do it. He'd put it in his hand, it would disappear. It was amazing. You're just a monk and you just do it and it was gone. But if you were standing in front of him, it would be gone. But if you were standing to the side, you'd see him throwing it over his shoulder. But the one who was watching couldn't see that. It was just a trick of perception. If you saw the whole thing, you could actually see. Have you ever seen a magician and seen the way it's done? Why don't you see how it's done? How did I not see that? Just like when you become enlightened. How did I not see that? That's why the Buddha called the consciousness the magician's trick. It really feels that it's me. It's me behind my eyes. It's me between the ears. I am listening to this. I am doing this. I am conscious. Magician's trick is empty. When you see all these things, nothing solid in the middle, that's emptiness, and it's also anatta. No self. That's why some years ago people asked, "Ajahn Brahm, how can we address you? Is it Bante or Ajahn or Venerable?" And I told people the right way to address a monk is your emptiness. Make a joke about it. Thank you.
Would any of the youths like to ask a question? Since this is for the youth. It's okay. Would any of the youths like to ask a question?
Okay.
Thank you. I'm actually. All right. Where do I begin? All right. I've seen a lot of monks actually giving blessings to devotees and disciples. I'm actually quite skeptical of the power of blessing. Or is that such thing? Is it actually an act of kindness, love, or is there such thing behind it?
The power of blessings. Okay. It depends on two things. First of all, the credibility of the listener. what they believe. And if a person has a lot of credibility, if they really believe that that blessing is going to do them some good, it does do them some good, obviously. Never underestimate the power of belief. Again, hypnosis. I mentioned many times a very famous experiment. They hypnotized a person and they had a nail on the end of a piece of wood. And they hypnotized this person. They convinced them it was red hot. It was at room temperature. So they touched the nail on this person's skin. And as you would expect, because he thought it was red hot, he screamed. What I never expected was a blister would come up. So his mind had actually made a physical impression on his body to get a blister, a burn, come up. Because he believed it was hot, it burnt him. It was cold. Never underestimate the power of the mind. If you believe that you're going to get cancer, you get that cancer. If you really have that powerful faith that cancer is going to be healed, it gets healed. Just like that person with the nail on the skin. So first of all, chanting depends on whether the person really believes it or not. If they do, it will have an effect no matter what you chant, or no matter who chants it. But it also, the effect of the person doing the chanting, whether you believe in it or not, that has a power itself. That's one mind on somebody else's mind or body. That also has an effect. So again, I've seen that happening.
We have only time for two more questions, so would anyone else like to ask
questions? Ajahn Brahm, recently I watched a TV show on renovating houses for poor people, and in this house they had to actually kill a lot of bed bugs to renovate the house. Is there any other way that we can do it, or what do we, should we do in such situations?
Okay, yeah, it's sometimes you do get in that situation. What can you do? It's sometimes in life that just we're stuck. We can't do it any other way. So if there was another way, I'd go to extremes to try and find another way. Even take the mattress outside and just leave it in the forest for a few days. Actually, I remember we used to do that in Thailand. If we got any infestation, like maybe some white ants, termites, we'd take it in a piece of wood, leave it in the sun. And then the termites didn't like the heat of the sun, so they'd actually crawl out. They would survive, but they'd be, you know, pretty angry at us, but at least they lived. So, I don't know, maybe you could air or sun the mattress or something, if that would work. But sometimes people just don't have that opportunity. So if ever that happens to you, remember, why on earth did you allow those bed bugs to get them in the first place? You know, that somebody was very heedless with their cleanliness, that they, you know, put these animals in this awful situation. So if that happens and you have to call the exterminator in, number one, ask forgiveness. So I'm really sorry we have to do this. And number two, make some merit and share it with them. We're not doing this out of anger, but we just haven't got any other choice. And number three, make sure you never have to do that again. It's very similar if a young girl has to have an abortion. And I mention this because this will happen to some of you here. Number one, if there's any other opportunity, any other thing to do, please do it. But if you really have got no choice, you have to do that. Ask forgiveness, make merit, and share the merit with that deceased being. And make sure you never get yourself in a position as a woman you have an unwanted child. Take precautions next time, whether it's saying no or having contraception, being tough on the boy, whatever else it is. You know, you're the one who has to carry the being. It doesn't matter. So in that particular situation, it's not you're sharing the problem. You, the woman, has to take that. That's totally unfair, but that's what nature is. Don't put yourself in that position. So in those situations, now make sure you don't get in that position again. If you are in that position, don't feel guilty. Do the best you can. And give yourself forgiveness and make merit and transfer it. Okay? And thanks for asking that question, because it gave me the opportunity to talk about abortion.
Hi, Ajahn Brahm. I would like to ask, you know, in light of the Singapore elections, right, is it really possible to be a very good Buddhist and a politician at the same time? Or you think that it's rubbish that you can be both at the same time?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because I've known politicians in Australia, and even though they haven't been Buddhist, actually they are Buddhist, but they haven't called themselves Buddhist. And yes, you can. Of course you can. As a Buddhist, any part of life you can be in, even in the military as well. Because I went to a conference, a one-day seminar in UK. It was the Buddhist members of the British military. And straight away, I accepted to go and give a talk, and I thought that these would be like the support staff, you know, the dentists, the accountants. I never thought there'd be a Buddhist in the front line. There was about two or three people. They were frontline soldiers. They'd been to Iraq. They were in Afghanistan. These were actually the soldiers who had guns in their hand, who actually shot those bullets. And they claimed to be Buddhist. Now, as a monk, I have got an incredibly open mind. At first, I thought, how on earth can you be a Buddhist and be shooting bullets at people at the same time? I couldn't understand it. I couldn't get my head around it. But I listened to them, and they convinced me that you could. I won't go into their argument, but they were sincere and honest. And when I heard that I thanked them. They educated me. So I think it would be the same with politicians. Yes, you can. It's a tough one, but you can do it. And in the end, I thought, I'd rather have a Buddhist in the military, someone who has got compassion, who isn't into revenge, who doesn't have anger. I'd rather have them protecting me than some people who are just psychopaths, into revenge, people who just get off on killing people or hurting people. I don't want those sort of people in the military. Same in politicians. What type of people would I want running my country? People who are just in it for themselves. People who just believe in one life, so get as much as I can out of it. Who cares? I'm soon going to die. I'm going to be out of here. Other people can sort out the problems of the ecology. As a Buddhist, because we believe in rebirth, reincarnation, we're going to come back here. So whatever we do to this planet, we're going to have to live with it. I've often said, if, you know, people like George W. Bush had believed in reincarnation, if he'd have really understood in his next life he's going to get reborn in Iraq, would that have changed his policies? It has a huge change in the way you look at this earth. We're not just going to, you know, use it and leave it. We're going to have to come back here again. So if you're going to have to come back here again, you have to look after this long term, sustainable. It's not just one lifetime. We'll be back here. What type of, you know, that's one of the great things with young. I always made this idea, because most politicians are old people, and those old people make decisions which they only have to live with for maybe 20, 30 years. Anyone here in their 20s will have to live with these decisions for 60 years. What they decide, you have to deal with much more than they do. That's why I really thought, in a democracy, we should actually change the weight of our votes. Anyone over, say, 80 has no vote at all. They're soon going to be out of here. It doesn't affect them. 60 to 80, maybe a quarter of a vote. Sort of 40 to 60, maybe half a vote. 20 to 40, the full vote. Isn't the same? If you're in a company and you're a shareholder, how many votes do you have? Depends on how many shares you have. You know, if you own half the company, you have half the votes. So the future of this world, young people, you have more shares in the future of this earth than do people who are 60. Therefore, you should have more vote. Isn't that logical? It will change the world when young people have more say in their future. But many of your future is decided by people who won't be here to live with the consequences of your of their actions, but you will have to live with those consequences. Interesting argument. Yeah. Edgar Casey, yeah.
Yes, exactly. He's a flipping prophet. And,
okay.
And he treated most of his, those people that approached him through his hypnosis.
Yep.
And through them, and one thing led to the other, which I chanced upon a book on Dr. Brian Wade.
Yes.
And he was talking about reincarnation, rebirth, and he was able to connect and see the connection with Buddhism, which is very much his
Be quick, yeah.
Yes. Many times we've been talking about love, compassion, you know, and Christianity always connects about staying in praise on the Lord, the God, and of course, a lot of teachers. But I do not see a lot of time that Buddhists, you know, mention about God. So I'm just want to hear from you.
You're asking the question, it's a long question, so when you ask a question, please get it precise.
Ajahn, okay. Could I trouble you to make it short? Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, okay. The Buddhist belief in God, that a God is a being who's not permanent, who comes and goes like other beings in this planet, not the creator of the universe, not all-powerful, not omniscient, just one other being in this universe. So not going to be there forever, not all-powerful. So if you actually pray to a God, a lot of times you're not going to get any answers. Because remember, if there's a God, there's about 10 billion people. Imagine having a sort of 10 billion... It's hard enough for me to answer questions to about 100 people. Imagine God always having to ask questions to so many people. It's impossible. And not always kind, just another being in the universe. So not an all-powerful, all-kind, benevolent, omniscient being. So totally different. You are the creator of the universe. So instead of putting responsibility onto somebody else, we take responsibility. And just believing in somebody else, no... You have to do something. So if you want to go to heaven, you have to be good. You can be a bad person and praise and praise and praise and think you're going to go to heaven. No way.
Thank you, Ajahn. Could we all say sadhu 3 times to Ajahn?